want to dance, you just get up there and move your body around to whatever best it happens to, whatever beat it happens to fall on. That's where it feels the best. But a lot of these kids are too embarrassed to even try it. The only place where they really get into that is L.A. Now, isn't it interesting that Zappa's talking about this stuff? He's always criticized. He's always complaining. He's not deluded. He's not going to be fooled by anything, right?
Yes, but it is true that maybe older generations were used to dance with a couple.
Right.
And have these different styles of music. And they even learned how to do each dance. And were not used just to...
They had
improvise.
Yeah, they had floor maps where your feet would be trained to move a certain pattern. So, yeah, improvising came in with Sputnik, said McLuhan. The Cape Canaveral caper, he called it, like doing the twist. How did he define it? He said, you're in a robot work situation. You know, it's quite rigid and corporate. So you want to unwind. So the dancing music was for a different reason than cultures 100 years before. People weren't coming in from a wound-up corporate robot life, and they maybe didn't want to unwind, or at least not so group-oriented. So he said they come in, and then he said you created your own space. You know, TV is making you want to create spaces, not to connect with someone else and then line up in a line and fit into a larger space. You make your own space. So he said you don't even have to be dancing with anybody. You're not holding arms and the hands and moving around a formula. You're creating your own space. So that is the ground of satellite environment. Everybody's creating interesting new spaces, including being terrorists and guerrillas and going around blowing up places. You're improvising something that threatens their surveillance around you. And these dances mirrored
actually,
that.
Dancing had the function of sort of... it was the only way young people could get near to each other.
Yeah.
And smell each other, talk to each other, and touch each other. So maybe when the introduction of drugs created a new situation where that was no longer necessary, that was no longer the function of dancing.
Right.
So people will start dancing on their own or be crazy on their own.
They didn't need to be to get contact with each other.
Freely, without this, like you say, the Watusi and all these names of different dances.
Yeah, they weren't visually biased people anymore who had to engage their other senses and press up against each other just to feel. Now everybody was feeling constantly in the bone conduction of the electronic resonance of all this electronic media around you. So you actually tried to slough off feeling and create a wall around yourself through gesture.
Yes, freaking out like they're freaking out. And there were also a lot of young people taking their clothes off. It was really like extreme.
Yeah.
From dancing all these very formal steps to the total freedom.
Dance is pretty good at showing the grounds of society over a couple hundred years. The different absurd formalities compared to the way people dance today or dance by the 60s is the best gauge of changing sense ratios. You know, you couldn't dance like they do in the 70s and 80s in a court in 1780. Well, they didn't even have the same soundscape.
Just left the conference.
Somebody just left. Thank you for letting us know. Okay. Let's carry.
Say bye.
This is a long interview. I don't know. I want to take a break. I don't know if I want to read the whole thing, but let me just read a little bit more. I want to go watch some TV. I'm going to take a break, and then we got to start again in 2 hours at 3 o'clock my time. So we're talking in Pelosi, but a lot of these kids are too embarrassed to even try it. And he's talking about in middle America. Where is this? It's being interviewed in Indianapolis. Okay. So the only place where they really get into that is L.A. Michael says, when we discussed the response to 200 motels last night, you made an allusion that it was a success, quote, despite the critics. Yeah, we heard some of that. Well, I was talking about the ethics of the critics. For one thing, the main critic of Los Angeles, I don't think has ever given... Where's the next part? Yeah, I don't think... Where is it? For one thing, the main critic of Los Angeles, I don't think has ever given a positive review to anything that Zubin Mehta has ever done. It seems like... I think his name is Bernheimer, has just had a hard on for Zubin since he got to town. You know, no matter what he does, it's always written up as shit. And Zubin's quite a good conductor. I've seen him I've attended maybe 5 of his concerts prior to the one he conducted with us. And I saw him do a boss version of Petrushka, that'd be Stravinsky, right? At a matinee concert that I couldn't believe. They were really cooking it. And it got maybe a little applause. Are you laughing at the cooking it? They were really cooking it?
Yeah.
And you, have you played Petrushka? Yes, recipe.
Ion lately is cooking it too.
Yes, yeah. Now, you've probably played Petrushka, right?
No, but I know the
piece. Okay.
I like Russian composers.
All right. And it got maybe a little applause because it was an old lady audience just back from the beauty shop. And stuff like that never gets reviewed. Like, nobody's happy with their audience, except maybe athletes. And stuff like that never gets reviewed. He did a version of The Miraculous Mandarin one night. You know that one? The Miraculous Mandarin.
No.
Okay. He did that one night. That was also just top 40, Frank says. It was also just top 40. He was really tearing ass on it. These are classical conductors. Tearing ass on it. Really cooking it. That sounds preposterous. And the orchestra.
The best classical music review.
Yes, it's Frank. And these guys are tearing ass. They tear it up on the weekend. And the orchestra has some good players in it. It has an especially nice percussion section, I think. And none of those things have ever gotten reviewed well by Bernheimer. And then the proof Bernheimer's reviewing... and then the proof of Bernheimer's reviewing was the Pierre Boulez concert a week or so after our show. And he reviewed it thusly, quote, "At last, the L.A. Philharmonic had played with precision," unquote. As if Mehta was some sort of schlep, and suddenly Boulez comes in and magically the orchestra is first rate. And that's not true, because, you know, Boulez is a very accurate conductor, but he didn't get the type of accuracy that was described in the newspaper article. Boulez was illuminating parts in the scores that I had never heard before. But as far as the orchestra playing together and really hitting it, no. 80% of the time, they weren't. Nothing to warrant the review that it got. He's quitting. He can't get it right at all. So Michael says, is this ethics or just lame ears? No, I think it's ethical. I think that there is probably some sort of personal conflict between that reviewer and the conductor of that orchestra. And the guy just said to himself, I'm going to get that son of a bitch. Now, how's this for a comment on classical music? You never heard your professor talk about this. I'm going to get that son of a bitch. Now, there's Frank. Frank's aware of the competitiveness, the sport game aspect of culture by the late 60s. You know what I mean? This is what we were talking about many hours ago, the violence that took over culture. And Frank, being in the thick of the new competitiveness of the baby boomers, knows it. So he... the reviewer says, I'm going to get that son of a bitch. And then Frank says, you know, I don't think the quality of the reviewing is honest. And then Michael says, he's one example. Then Frank says, well, I'll give you a better example. How about Time Magazine? A week before the concert, they sent a writer, this guy named Tim Tyler. He came to my house and asked me a few questions about the thing. Then he says in front, quote, you're probably not going to like what I write about your show. He's telling him he's going to give it a bad review. And I said, why is that? Frank says, and why is that? And the guy, Tim Tyler, responds, well, they want me to cover it from the standpoint of, I got to find a musician in the orchestra that hates your music, and we're going to cover it from his point of view. Wow. This is incredible. Every time you read a Zappa interview, something interesting happens. That's incredible. The guy actually told him, well, we have to have a guy hate you. So this is, they're banning, they've already banned Frank from pop radio. Now that he's going into the classical field, they're out to get him there. This is like incredible. He's like a Wyatt Earp or a popular sheriff in the cowboy days, walking into town, cleaning up the criminals. Most of the society is criminal and they hate Frank. Keeps cleaning up the messes. Sounds like me.
Well,
that's why I'm so hated. Hated by millions of people. Just because, well, they can't figure out what I'm doing. All right, so they can't figure out what Frank's doing. And he said, well, Frank, he deserves it. He was satirizing everybody. He didn't realize people would not like being satirized. Even editors of magazines in New York City. So Tyler says, well, they want me to cover it from the standpoint of I gotta find a musician in the orchestra that hates your music, and we're gonna cover it from his point of view. Jesus.
Oh.
And it's Frank goes, so what can you do? They come and tell you that up front, man. And so he scoured the orchestra, tried to find somebody. Trying to find somebody who really didn't like doing it. And he couldn't find anybody. So then he really started scraping around and trying to get somebody to say some bad shit. Uh-oh, Bob's going to start dying laughing. Here we go. Here, Bob's going down the laughter hole. Where are we? He's trying to get somebody to say some bad shit about it. And he explained it to me this way. He said, figure the type of people who read Time Magazine. It's a businessman, and he doesn't like music anyway. But he's looking for something to chuckle over, as if the whole movie section of Time is for the edification of some guy who sells aluminum siding. And nobody who has any interest in the arts ever reads it, which is probably true. But he says the function of Time Magazine is not to do a musical review because, quote, we're not really qualified to review the music, unquote. And I didn't even see the article, but I'm sure that it did.
Alyssa.
Just left the conference.
I gotta click something off. Unlocked name, exit name. It says here you got to go none. I don't know how I got back. Oh, maybe I refreshed it. But remember, I read the people, the Time Magazine section on people, the short item. They got it all wrong about Frank and that little item, right? They got it wrong.
Yeah.
So, so he's saying that the editors of Time Magazine. Now, this is targeted media management. They know their readers, an illiterate, semi-cultured nobody, jerk, and, no, not necessarily nobody, he could be a famous businessman, but they got no culture, and Time Magazine must design their magazine to have that attitude, to laugh and mock whatever they're reviewing. Now, McLuhan wrote about Time Magazine way back in the 40s, early 50s, said, you can't get truth in Time Magazine style. In Time Magazine style, there's no truth. So, back to this point. See, like, here's Frank talking. He's doing media ecology. He's talking about the media environment he's got to live in, not talking about the concert, or, you know, or he talks a little bit of the concert, but then he covers his whole media angle, which is pretty interesting, eh?
Yes. Because I think the magazine was always famous for their pictures.
Yes.
Was it more like a visual thing than a content
yes.
thing?
Yes, right. And Life magazine was even more famous for pictures. So, okay, but he says the function of Time magazine is not to do a music review because we're not really qualified to review the music. And I didn't even see the article, but I'm sure that it didn't say anything at all about the music in italics. So Michael says, well, a lot that I've heard about the concert seems to erect a kind of legend of outrage, like that moment in the Marx Brothers movie, Night at the Opera, when Chico and Harpo tear up the overture. Like, people will believe you had the violins blow bubbles. Anything that sounds freaky or strange, that people would respond, yeah, Zappa would do that. So he could only be a cliche. Yeah, like, people will believe you had the violins blow bubbles. Anything that sounds freaky or strange, that people would respond, yeah, Zappa would do that. So what's Zappa going to say to that? He says, well, I've got the scores here if you'd like to see them. He proved to you what they played. And everything that those people were doing was all written into the score. You know, I didn't just say, quote, okay, when you get done, you over here. You watch what he says. I jumped ahead. Okay, when you get done, you over here. You you make an ass out of here. Jesus. Okay. Even Zubin Mehta didn't have to explain himself like this. So Frank says, okay, when you get done, you over here. Okay, you over here, you make an ass out of yourself this
way. Oh, we're not going to make it. We're going to have to take a break.
Oh, Jesus. Let me just get this. I can't even see the thing now. I'm crying. Get the water out of my eyes. you over there, you. It's almost like it was written in the score. You make it at. Jesus Christ. Okay. Okay, I'm going to try. I'm not going to laugh. I am laughing, but I'm not going to laugh, all right, so we can get it through. Okay, when you get done, you over here, you make an ass out of yourself this way. And you over there, you make an ass out of yourself that way. Jesus. Okay, all right. Let me just check. How are they responding in the chat lines? Anybody talking this? Anybody hearing us? No, no commentary. Okay, so you make an ass out of yourself that way. So then, end of that quote. Then Zap says, it was all part of the musical concept. And I think one chick wrote that at a certain point in the performance, the brass section stood and tore their music off. Jesus. They tore their music up and threw it in the air. Threw it in the air. And threw it in the air, which was untrue.
No, he did not. Jesus Christ.
These reviewers are making it. I think they were hallucinating. Holy shit. That's incredible. Which was untrue. What happened there was, in the score it says, quote, horns stand and shuffle decks of cards, unquote. Well, in a normal acoustic environment where you have some resonance to the room, if nothing else is playing and the horn section stands and goes whoop like that with a deck of cards, it's a sound. They made the sound of ripping. But in a basketball area, in a basketball area, it doesn't make much sound at all. And they'd been doing it, but it just wasn't coming off. So I didn't know. So I didn't know it. But they had decided among themselves at that point. And that's why. Even the orchestra rebels. And they decided among themselves at that point they're going to stand and throw the decks of cards all over the violas. And the viola players just went, what? Because all these cards are coming down on them. So they did that. These players were so used to being disciplined that when they were given a little freeway to do what they want, they turned juvenile delinquents and little kids just started being silly. Frank couldn't control him. And the viola players just went, what? Because all these cards are coming down. It was actually great, says Frank. And I didn't mind them improvising on the score at all. Okay. Mike says, that theatrical act.
They did the, what was the word, dumping? You say it when they throw confetti?
Oh, yeah, bunting. They did the bunting thing, yeah. Bunting.
Yeah.
It was actually great. So then they're complaining. He's shocked at the reviewer, but he doesn't mind them doing that. But it looks like the reviewer didn't understand what was happening. Heard the rip and thought they did tear their music up, but they didn't tear the music up. They tore the cards up. And it was just a sound effect they were making. They didn't tear up the cards. They made a sound, brap, as if they were tearing it up, and it, but they did throw it on the people. And Frank liked that. That Michael says, that theatrical act is an improvisation on the score? Frank said, right. Then you do compose in terms of theatrical elements in the music. Frank says, absolutely. Have you felt your records were ever sufficiently reviewed? Well, there have been some glaring exceptions to that. There have been about three really perceptive reviews that I've read about any of the work that I've been involved in, but they're spread out, and they're usually in publications that never reach a mass audience. So our image is brought to the public by magazines and newspapers and such that reach the largest number of people, and that's where the worst reviewers are, in the larger publications. And so what are you going to do? I mean, he had the same communication problem I have. Like, he gets, nobody cares. And so what are you going to do? The only place where we really get a decent break is in Europe. Well, I could say, I shouldn't say like I have, but like Ion has. They have people misinterpreting us all over the place. And so what are you going to do? The only place where we really get a decent break is in Europe. Because we do really, because we do really pounds of press over there. I guess he means he does a lot of interview. Like, we just got back, and I must have done 40 interviews in the time I was there. And those papers have large circulations. And it seemed the professionalism of the reviewers was right up there. They took the job seriously. Even though some of them were young kids, they were very thorough, and they had their questions mapped out. Oh, there's that old French education again. Like in America, they haven't been taught to do anything in decades. You guys have the strict education. These kids are, they can do the serious thing. They had their questions mapped out, and they took time to write down exactly what you said. There was one horrible exception to that, which appeared in the largest British paper, the Daily Express, multi-million circulation. This guy was a little drunk when he was writing down my answers and came up with some strange things. But in general, the pop trade papers like Melody Maker, things like that, and other newspapers I dealt with over there, guys were really serious about what they were doing. So Michael says,
I would like to make a short, small comment.
Yes, go ahead.
When I went to America, I was really impressed that there was this test with multiple options.
When you were as a kid, you mean when you were 12 years old in Washington?
Yes, because I never had that type of test in the French school, and I thought that was sort of very silly, stupid. You have A, B, and C instead of writing an essay or a summary or something. This is like, that's it? Just A, B, and C? That's the test? I was really shocked, like, what is this?
Wow, yeah, I can imagine. You didn't have to do any creativity, any memory. You just had to tick off what seemed to be true, make a choice. Yeah.
Yes, but that doesn't teach you how to think or organize your ideas. It's just remembering data.
Right. No,
memorizing data.
LaRouche hates, he writes in his books way back then, he hates that testing. He's ranting against that kind of testing. Okay, Michael says, European critics are often characterized as cats, incredibly sensitive to honesty in how well your music is what you intend it to be. American critics sometimes seem to write about personality more, or in some instances, what they would rather your music be than what it is. Zappa says, well, in America, there's two things that stand in the way. One, art in any shape or form is not a necessity to the American public. Now, McLuhan would describe that technically. Why would there be interest in a painting or a music when you got TV and movies to watch, right? Much media must post Gutenberg art. So Frank is not explaining it, but he's saying he knows that's the fact. Art in any shape or form is not a necessity to the American public. They really don't feel that it's an integral part of their lifestyle, which means their later media mix. You know, it's just a diversionary facility, part of the general leisure time boom. It's always been advertised in the United States. Well, art? Anybody can do it. Everybody's an artist. Okay, turning the page. Everybody's a singer. You can play the guitar, you can play the piano, so there's nothing special about a person who has the ability to do something specific and who has devoted his life to doing that one thing. It's taken for granted, just like maybe the plumber could fix a car because they're both made out of metal and they both have tubes in them. So you've got that to overcome in the first place. The other thing is that because of the way the public views an artist in the United States, certain neurotic things creep into the personalities of the artists who live here. Because you're isolated, and you're already viewed as something that came out from under a rock. And in many instances, the people begin to act that role. This is especially true in jazz circles, I've noted. And that just serves to push the audience farther away from them. So when you come up against an interviewer who's looking for a story, who needs to serve a certain thing on assignment for his magazine, or paper, then you haven't got a chance, because he'll make you look like a buffoon, or he'll make you look like some sort of a creep or whatever. They make you look that way. That's not the way you are. Wow. Pretty interesting. Right?
Yes. Yes, also the insight that he would write all these gestures in his course. You find that also very interesting.
These gestures?
Because they thought it was...
Oh, yeah, yeah, the action. Yeah.
The actions, they thought that they were improvised in real time, but sometimes they were also scored, so I didn't know that.
All right. Hey, you know what? I just remember Bill won't let me stop at the bottom of the hour. I've got to go till 2, so I guess we are going to finish it. Then I'll only have an hour for my fun. Damn. Grumble. I'm not used to not getting my way. Okay. Let's see. But this is fun. This is pretty interesting. I read this. This is 40 years ago. 44, 45 years ago. I don't remember any of this.
Wow.
Yeah, the... Actually, this is the this guy, Mike Bourne, interviewed Frank in 1970. That's the one I read. I may never have read this one, which is a year or so later. But Frank was always exposing the ground, the mechanics of an environment. You know, he's talking about what it's like to be a critic, how you'd be a critic, what the critic says about itself. He's showing you the process involved in the role.
Yes, and another thing I found very interesting is that our senses doesn't work just like on its own, like you just hear, you just see, or you just... They're all on all the time. So there is this interaction of the senses, and I like that he was aware of that, and he will do... verbivocal-visual.
Right. Verbivocal-visual. Right.
Compositions, not
yes.
only acoustic.
Right. Now, that's right. He's operating from a tactile position, which is not a sense. It's the thing that's orchestrating the different senses. So it's orchestrating verbi, vocal, and visual, and kinetic, and proprioceptive. He's working all the different sensory phenomena. So what?
Yes, and,
what did you say? You said something.
I think it's the first time I noticed that.
Well, what did you notice? It? You mean when I read it to you? What do you mean?
When you just listened, read that that he was composing not only acoustics, not
right.
only with sounds and notes, and he was composing in a wider way. He was
yes.
verbi, vocal, visual.
All the verbi, vocal, visual.
He was, he was composing for all the senses. He was not, he was making music that would be interesting to play and to experience, because it's not only listened.
Right.
It was to be seen, to be engaged with the movement, to...
Like a movie.
There as a participating...
Multi-senses, synesthesia.
Yes.
That's, that proves my point that he's a tactile creator, not just a musician.
Yes.
That's why he says this is a movie for your ears. So he's he's trying to do what McLuhan's pointing out. McLuhan's saying, hey, we're not a simple visual society anymore. We've got multimedia, multi-senses. He's trying to show the same message. In a music context, whereas McLuhan was doing it in a book context. So, yeah, it's good to notice that.
Yes, and some people may have thought he was only being like a clown. the fatty communion.
Yes. He'd just be manipulated. Like, why would, they're thinking, hey, I'm listening to some music. Why would people throw a card deck up in the air? What's that got to do with my ears? But he was showing more than the ears. He's probably going beyond John Cage. You're going further into it. The multi-sensory
synesthesia. Yes, he was not limiting himself to be a serious composer. He was really pushing all boundaries in the genres with the senses.
Right. When we talked to Pauline Oliveros, I was thinking, I brought it up, I thought she was emphasizing the ear too much, so I gave her the benefit of the doubt and said, you are actually trying to point out stuff beyond the ear. And she was. But Frank does it simply. She's still focusing on the ear too much, so to speak. On listening, deep listening. Maybe she means by deep listening exactly what Frank was trying to do. Multimedia. Having your ears notice the other senses. Right? What do you think?
Yes, and well, the fact that she said we listen with the skin, for example.
Right.
We don't only listen with ears. We listen, like Frank said, with the eyes.
Right, with the other senses.
Like all the senses interact, I remember reading some articles on how at the beginning people would get upset because they saw a keyboard and then all these crazy synthesized sounds will came out of the speakers and people were expecting like an organ or a keyboard, a piano.
And where did you experience this?
A synthesizer with a keyboard. That was an article I read a long time ago about
the effect of the first synthesizers.
Yes, that the people, yes, because we don't only listen with our ears.
Right.
People are seeing a keyboard and they're expecting to hear an organ or a piano. And all these crazy sounds were coming out and they could not relate both the visual and what they were listening.
Right. It was a shock.
Now, yes, now it's no problem, but at the beginning, some composers were having trouble with the audience just because of that.
Right, right.
Like they were asking, where are all these sounds coming from?
Okay, let me... that was very interesting. So let me see, where are we at? Oh yeah, they try to make you look like a buffoon. Okay, so then Michael says, one of the strange aspects to revolutionary aesthetics is this idea that once the revolution comes, we will all begin to spontaneously create, because we're all essentially artists. Everyone has this creative essence that will be immediately exposed if the government changes. That as well, I think that everybody does have a creative essence about them, but they should realize that that essence exists in varying degrees from person to person, and the emphasis of that essence shifts. Some people might be a little bit better expressing themselves in clay, for instance, or with finger paints, and definitely should not take up the saxophone. Michael says, do you think you've had an influence more by your music or by your image? Frank says, influence over what? Michael says, other artists. Frank says, I think we've definitely had an influence over other musical groups, obscure as the Mother's Invention might have been, because I hear things now happening, especially in groups coming out of Europe, that would not have been possible if we hadn't taken the first step and said, you don't have to play three-chord blues to make it sound like rock and roll. Pop music can exist in time signatures other than three and four. Lyrics do not have to be about boy-girl situation. It's not enough to just say that in an interview and then have it published someplace, and then some guy who's forming a group read it and go, yeah, quote, yeah, maybe that's true. We don't have to play in 3-4, unquote. You have to do it on a record and say, look at that. Maybe you didn't sell a million, but that's how to do it. And we did it. We did all those things a long time ago, and now it's happening over there. We played in Germany 2 years ago. There were a lot of local groups that come in the afternoon and do that gig, and I would say that 40% sounded like side four of the Freakout album. Michael says, I responded to that, the fourth side, the return of the Son of Monster Magnet. Well, wait a minute, he says, I responded to that, the return of the Son of Monster Maggot, side four of the Freakout album, like I first responded to Coltrane's Ascension. I forgot that Coltrane did a song called Ascension, or an album or whatever. Like when I first heard it, I wasn't ready for it. But then later, after experiencing the music more and more, I would go back to it, and it would by then sound even tame. But you've often been compared to Dada, especially more so in discussions of Cat'n Beefheart and other groups you manage. Do you feel this is a conscious element in your music, a kind of overt craziness? Frank goes, Dada? Well, some people may find it hard to believe, but my music is a direct extension of my lifestyle. And I try to keep it. I remember Frank didn't know what Dada was at some point. Anyways, he says, but my music, he goes, Dada, question mark. Well, some people may find it hard to believe, but my music is a direct extension of my lifestyle. And I try to keep it as closely related to the way I think when I'm off stage, no matter what the music is. In other words, he's talking about off stage. He's trying to make it match what life is for him, or his media diet. In order for me to feel natural playing it, it has to be pretty close to the way I feel when I'm off the stage. That's too much of a jolt to have to manufacture something that would be overtly crazy and be anything other than that off the stage. And then go up there and suddenly turn it on. You know, it's cultural shock. So he's actually saying he can't act. He can't make it up. He can't just be crazy in a silly way. It has to fit some kind of order that he has in his daily life. Michael says, some Hoosier, which is like a university guy, some Hoosier reading that might respond, quote, oh wow, he likes to ball vegetables. He likes to fuck vegetables. Some Hoosier reading that might respond, oh wow, he likes to ball vegetables. And then Frank says, well, am I to be held to blame for the reading comprehensive Sorry. Well, am I to be held to blame for the reading comprehension of somebody from Indiana? So, no, he's not to be held to blame. So there's a break, and now dig this question. So they have a, it looks like they, part two of the interview. And we've done 1, 2, 3 pages. And what's coming?
It's a very good interview, I think.
Yeah. And so then it says, Michael says, are you only in it, there's the big question, are you only in it for the money? Zappa says, no. And that's another criticism that I have of reviewers. Because on the day that that album was released, the thing that escaped everybody was the fact that it was designed to show that the Beatles were only in it for the money. Not that we were. if we were only in it for the money, we'd be doing something else. if we were only in it for the money, we'd be doing something else. I mean, to look at that cover and to see the people on that cover and say that these guys are, you know, they're wearing dresses on the cover. Stupid, you know,
yeah.
Silly, bad dresses. And say that these guys are only in it for the money.
That was a really provoking statement.
Yes.
We are doing this only for the money because it's
and it's a joke, though.
As an artist, Yes.
Yeah, it's a joke because it's obviously not how you attract money. It's like they're idiot savants, not even savants, they're idiots. They don't know how to be worth the money, and they do it all wrong. They really did know. They really did want to make it funny, but they were so retarded, they thought, well, maybe this will make money. That's pretty funny. He didn't even know how to sell himself, is the joke. Right? They're pretending.
Yes, that's what we were saying before when we were talking about the troubadours, how he will do this
outrageous thing.
Say this type of things to make people think about what are they doing, what they're doing. For
they don't mean it. They're not in it for the money.
Yeah.
Now, here's what's interesting is Zappa did know how to market his stuff. He was a clever advertiser. Maybe he wants to make sales, but he knew how to get attention. He knew where to advertise Freak Out. He did it in children's comic books. He was quite innovative in how he promoted the first album. At least that's what the myth is. He says, so, I mean, to look at that cover and to see the people on that cover and say that these guys are only in it for the money, I thought that was the funniest thing we could have put together. But automatically, everybody assumed that that was the exact truth. And nobody stopped to question for a minute the relationship between the Sgt. Pepper cover style and the title. You know, they never once questioned that the Beatles might be anything other than directly descended from heaven. And I personally felt for a long time that they were extremely plastic and flat-out commercial. Mike says, well, the response was usually, oh, a parody of the Beatles cover. Zappa says, no. Likely, they didn't even know it was a parody of the Beatles cover. I'd say 30% of the audience didn't know it was a parody of the Beatles cover. And Michaels disagrees with Frank. I doubt that. I think people are sharp enough to see something that blatant. Frank says, do you? It's like Ion. Oh, do you? Even though it's inside out? Because remember, you couldn't see the Beatles stuff. They weren't allowed to put it on the outside. Paul McCartney wouldn't let them, so it was hidden. Do you? Even though it's inside out? Think about it. It would have been released the other way if the Beatles hadn't screwed it up. We had to get permission from them to put it out. Michael says, when We're Only In It for the Money was reissued, censored, I recognize most of the cuts for being naughty words or such, like flower power sucks, sucks, sucks. But I never could figure out why that line from Let's Make the Water Turn Black was cut. The one, quote, I still remember Mummy with her apron and her pad feeding all the boys in Ed's Cafe, unquote. Frank says, that was cut because some executive at MGM thought pad meant sanitary napkin. And the image of Mummy feeding the boys a sanitary napkin was too much for feeding
imagination.
Yeah, feeding, you know, handing a sanitary napkin as food was too much for him. Can you imagine where that guy's head was? Bryce is as shocked by the people as they are of him. Can you imagine where that guy's head was to make that connection?
Yeah.
damaged people. So Michael says, still, a lot of your lyrics evoke strange images for many people, some very startling, like on Concentration Moon, about the cops shooting kids, which really takes on a new significance after Kent State. That's a murder. The cops killed some students in May 1970. Frank says, you get a different perspective. That song was written in 1967, 3 years before Kent State. Then Michael says, the lyrics in The Hunchback Duke about student leaders also indicates an attitude, a disfavorable one that most college kids most likely don't expect. So the lyrics in The Hunchback Duke put down student leaders. And so that's an attitude, a disfavorable one that most college kids most likely don't expect. Frank says, I don't like student leaders because I don't think that they're really qualified leaders. I don't think they're offering their constituency anything that resembles wisdom or leadership and serve only the same function, and they serve only the same function as Chubby Checker, showing you how to do the twist by putting a bath towel around his buns to give you the idea of how you're supposed to move. what is this? So he's saying that the student leaders are just like Chubby Checker. Let me see. They're offering their I don't think they're offering their constituents anything that resembles wisdom or leadership, and serve only the same function. Well, I guess he says in the next sentence that they're just fads. So that's what he means. They actually, student leaders only serve the same function as Chubby Checker, showing you how to do the twist by putting a bath towel around his buns to give you the idea of how you're supposed to move. And they also see that the whole revolutionary trend this season is a fad that's similarly based to a dance craze or flower power or transcendental meditation. And as soon as something comes along to replace it, this will blow over, because the people who are actively involved in what they think is a revolution right now haven't the faintest idea what they're doing. And then Michael says, like what they used to be called spring fever is now called politics. Frank Zappa says, it occurred to me the other day that the American public, at the point when the peace negotiations were announced in Paris, thought that was a great way. We'll negotiate and we'll bring about peace. And everybody sort of welcomed that. I'm surprised that same sort of rational approach, I'm not saying that the peace talks ever could have been successful, but that the same sort of rational approach couldn't be applied to the domestic grievances of the people who have been abused by the government. You know, they haven't even really sought a way to bring their grievances to the attention of the people that might be able to do something about it. And they're also too lazy to take the steps that would be the most effective to correct these grievances. Because a demonstration doesn't correct grievances. The Mexicans need to learn this. It only does two things. It polarizes the good guys from the bad guys, and that changes from whichever standpoint you want to look at it as to who's good and who's bad, and it only serves to notify the other party that you're pissed off about something.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. It's not effective communication, which was the reason McLuhan went public, to improve communication skills. He says, you're telling them you're pissed off about something, but it doesn't correct the situation. And I think that everybody's been notified already. You know, everybody's got the idea. So now the thing to do is change it. If you can't go directly to the government and say, look here, we're the majority, these people under 25, and we've got some needs that aren't being taken care of, and we don't like this, and we don't like that, do something about it. If you can't take the direct approach, then you have to do something a little bit more incognito. One of the things that I've been advocating all along is called slot power. Holy shit. I've been looking for this quote for fucking 20 fucking years, and I could never find it. I knew it was in Downbeat.
Wow.
Yeah, I knew it was in Downbeat, but I never looked at this fucking article. It's too long. I actually, in my mind, thought it was a short article. So that means I did read this interview. I remember standing in a store and reading it. I didn't buy it. I just read it in the store. This is quite a discovery. And I thought it was called Suck Power.
Yes, you see, the Trubador found it.
I found it! I've been looking for this. Another discovery. Barry, and you were here to witness it. That's right. I always thought it was called Suck Power, and you'll see what I mean. But he says it's Slot Power, S-L-O-T. So I like this. He's saying, like all those Mexicans last year, they were protesting millions. Why don't they just march up and demand to get in the office, I guess, is what he's saying. Or what, you send up some representatives? Not that they're going to be responded to, but it's interesting he's saying, you know, going out and doing a mass demonstration is not effective. Who are you communicating to? You're just communicating to the TV camera, which isn't the city hall or the government. So, anyway, so that's a pretty good, that's like the kid who sees the emperor is not wearing any clothes. So he's looking at the protesters, seeing they haven't got any clothes on, or any new clothes. So he goes, if you can't take the direct approach, then you have to do something a little bit more incognito. So now, here's the more incognito thing. One of the things that I've been advocating all along is called slot power, where a lot of the hippie girls, who are now, say, some of the ones in Chicago who joined the Weathermen and helped make Molotov cocktails, you know, the radical terrorists almost, they would be better off going into an uptown bar with a different set of clothes on and picking up executives and industrials and maybe eventually marrying these people and exerting a profound influence on the lives of the men who actually have control of the material things in the United States, and just sort of by inference and pressure from another direction could cause a great deal of things to change. Now, I remember him saying, I thought he said they should go and give these guys blowjobs. That's why he called it suck power. maybe this isn't the suck power thing I'm looking for, but unless he's going to say a little further, this is an early version of it called slot power. I don't know where the slot is. So, would you do that? Would you, for the movement, go marry some executive and have him give him a healthy sex life? No, you wouldn't do that.
Well, because the royals did all the time, like...
oh, yeah, that's right.
Frank the First was the enemy of Charles the Fifth, and then his grandchild, Isabella, went to marry the son of Charles the Fifth.
Yeah.
So that's how they will influence the houses.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they don't... Not just
somebody
doing...
from the family there to be the wife of the enemy.
right. They did this infiltration. That's right. Yeah, that's right. They're doing what he's telling. Infiltrate
it
the enemy.
More effective than war.
Right. Okay, let me just tell Bill. Hey, Bill, I'm taking a break. In 10 minutes. And he's going to play some music as we go out. Okay, take a break in 10 minutes, and I have carte blanche to press the panic button to wake him up. Panic button, Bill. I'm taking a break in 10 minutes. 9 minutes now. Maybe even 8 minutes. Okay, so let's see if I can finish this. This is tremendous. You have to realize how many articles I have to pick from. I always pick the good stuff. Or what seems to be good.
And the right thing for today.
Right.
Each day.
That's right. So he's saying, so that's interesting. Yes, the royals knew what to do. Mike says, that's not your basic working through the system ideal. You know, you go into the system and you work your way through it. That's not your basic working through the system ideal. And then Frank says, but it's still a lot tidier than going out and blowing things up. And the other way is, and this is an especially effective tactic in the Midwest where you have a lot of small towns, if you think you really know where it's at and you're a long-haired kid, you know, and you really got the best interest of the United States at heart and you're really patriotic and you really want to change things, what you do is you get some of your buddies together and you go to a small town and you cut your hair, and as soon as you're old enough to vote, you just take it over. And this has been done a couple places on the West Coast. You get your own sheriff, and you get your own mayor, and your own city council, and then you've got a town. But see, there's a lot of these kids that know deep down that if that ever happened, they would be forced to accept the responsibilities of actually running that town. And then what do you do? They're not ready for that. And Michael says, there's an impatience about that also. And Zappa says, but impatience is irrelevant, man. You can't be impatient about something that's this fucked up. They actually censored that in the magazine. You can't be impatient about something that's this fucked up, that took this long to get fucked up, hundreds of years, and you're not going to undo it with one demonstration. He makes it sound absurd, even the idea of having a demonstration. You're not going to undo it with one demonstration. To me, that's a result of media talk. To me, that's a result of television. Television has shortened your interest span and led you to seek out things like instant TV dinners. I know it's worked on me, definitely. I can't wait 2 seconds to get something to eat if I'm hungry. Somebody could offer me the greatest meal in the world if I waited 2 hours. And if I'm starving to death, I'll eat a peanut butter sandwich. Somebody could offer me the greatest meal in the world if I waited 2 hours. And if I'm starving to death, I'll eat a peanut butter sandwich. You know, that's exactly the way it is. And it's the same with these kids. Or it's the same with those kids. They think, you know, quote, we'll just go out there and we'll stand around in the street and we'll scream and somebody will squirt us with gas and then we'll have a revolution. Yeah, we laughed about this before.
That's very interesting because that explains why we are so impatient.
Yeah. Your TV body is used to being satisfied instantly all the time. And then you know, the chip body is equally so. Man, oh man. And they don't
For example, that we just Google things, and I can't even get the books of my ancestors
right.
online.
Right.
I don't have to go to a library and photocopy them or wherever.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Like, everything is instant. So, yeah, we're not used to long processes. And it's very interesting because already McLuhan was doing culture is our business like slogans.
Yes.
And now we see Trump is so popular because he's not giving long discourses. He's just...
He's not even finishing his sentence. That's how far gone it is.
Yes, but for people, that's perfect because they don't have this attention span.
They actually know what he... They don't have to finish it. They know what he's talking about. So they know the thought. They've heard it 100 times, so they just... They know where he's going to go with it. They got ESD from information overload. Okay, I don't think I'm going to finish.
I mean, everybody's texting and doing this... smileys and full sentence.
Yeah, what's his name? He should come out and just flash a smiley.
He just has to say lol. That's it.
Yeah, he should just have a slideshow. He doesn't even have to speak. He just puts up images and everybody responds to the images. That'd be neat. They could boo, they could yell, you know, make it a PowerPoint, they call it. Okay, so he says, and then we'll get squirt with gas, and then we'll have a revolution. And Michael says, and we'll wear our scars like medals after they get beat up. Zappa says, yeah, that's right. Michael says, I notice in both theater and in music this kind of impatience, an inability to wait and appreciate what is happening, wanting it to be over, to have already experienced it without having to expend too much time. Well, that's a product of the instant replay. You have the meaning before the experience. So actually, Bill's asking, what time back on? I'll say 3 p.m., 3 a.m. We'll only get an hour break because I think we agreed. It depends on whether Ion shows up. Okay, I'll just say 3 a.m., so in an hour. Now, where were we? Yeah, the instant replay makes people really impatient. Zappa says, you want it to be over so you can clap. Michael says, so you can file it. And Zappa's quoting somebody. I heard that solo the other night. I heard that guy play 27 choruses of Lady is a Tramp. And then Michael, they're jamming here, he quotes, and I applauded like I never applauded before. It's all about the clapping. How much clapping you get to do. And then Frank goes, yeah, he was heavy. He's quoting somebody. Then Michael says, are you a fatalist then? Do you think there's a chance to get out of it all? Do you think there's a chance to get out of it all? A chance to educate the public? A chance to... Frank says, yes, 50-50. That's optimism, 50-50. Michael says, a kid asked me to ask you, quote, what possessed you to pose for that poster sitting on a toilet? Well, this is a good thing. Good story. Frank goes, okay, it went like this. I had no idea there was ever going to be a poster. That picture was taken in a toilet in the Royal Garden Hotel in London and was part of a publicity campaign for our first appearance in England. And so the guy that took it just decided to make a poster out of it. And due to the copyright laws in England, the photographer owns the photographs. Here, the photographer here in England, that's where he's, well, I don't know. No, here in America, here the photographer owns the photograph, but he doesn't own the right for your image on it unless you give him a release. There in England, they don't need a release. So he took the thing and went out and made a poster out of it. Well, it pissed me off, and I couldn't do anything about it because they had a whole bunch of them on the market. And it's probably one of the best-selling posters of all time, though I haven't seen any money at all from it. It's bootlegged all over the place. Somebody makes a poster of it, somebody else will take a photograph of that poster and print up his own. There are 2 or 3 different varieties of it that are circulating all over Europe. Well,
yes.
That's maybe a little bit more. Yay! End of part one.
Yes.
The longest show in the history of radio. We've been on the air for 11 hours. No, 12 hours.
Ew. 12 fucking hours, baby.
wonderful things with music.